In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 418. One of the topics that comes up quite a bit when talking about the Federal Reserve and Austrian economics is the problem of the panics that occurred before we had a Federal Reserve. And the argument is we had all this economic instability in the 19th century, and that goes to show that we needed the stabilizing hand of modern central banking and that that has improved things. So it's very important for Austrians to go back and look at these panics and try to account for them. How did they happen? Were they the result of capitalism run wild and so on and so forth? That's what we need to do. And I actually done an episode on this. One of the most listened to episodes of this program is the episode I did on this very subject. I will link to that on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/418. I also have a resource page, a free resource page filled with resources on exactly this, the panics before the Fed. And that, I believe it's libertyclassroom.com/panics. I should have checked it before going on here and recording. It's either that or tomwoods.com/panics. But whichever one it is, I will link to that resource as well at tomwoods.com/418. But joining us to talk about this historical episode, namely the Depression of the 1870s, 1873 to 1879, is Patrick Newman, the author of an important new scholarly journal article on this subject, and of course I will be naturally linking to his article at tomwoods.com/418 as well. Patrick Newman is a second-year PhD student in the Department of Economics at George Mason University. He's a graduate of Rutgers University. He was a summer fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and he won the Mises Institute's Douglas French Prize in 2012 for the student who emerges from the Mises University oral examinations with the best record as chosen by the examining committee. And I was on that committee, and Patrick was clearly the best candidate. So it's quite an impressive thing to come out of Mises U and be ranked the number one student because you got a lot of really, really tough competition there. So Patrick is doing very, very important work, and I'm very glad to welcome him now. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
You have performed a very, very important service here by writing this journal article on the Depression of the 1870s, because I've often said that from a point of view of economic history, one thing that we need quite a bit of is an examination of the various panics and economic downturns in U.S. history, particularly those that occurred before the Federal Reserve, because they'll claim that these are pieces of evidence that we needed a Federal Reserve, that a central bank could, in fact, smooth out the business cycle, so to speak, that it could improve economic conditions. And there really isn't a whole lot of work done on that from an Austrian perspective. We do have the Rothbard book, a collection of his chapters and articles that takes you through the 19th century. In fact, I think on today's show notes page, I will link to that, his history of money and banking in the U.S. So that'll be on tomwoods.com/418. What made you focus on the 1870s in particular?
So as you said, in terms of Austrians, there hasn't really been a lot of research done on the panics before the Federal Reserve. So the biggest one's been the Great Depression. You know, we have Rothbard's America's Great Depression. Then next in line has been the Depression of 1920 to 21. And so there's been various works, sometimes papers critiquing the Austrians on this. But there hasn't really been, as you said, a lot on the panics before the Federal Reserve. So I wanted to do one that was after the Civil War, because a lot of times with the older panics, the Panic of 1819, we also had Rothbard, he did his dissertation on that, 1837, 1857. A lot of some of the data can be very spotty. And a lot of people say that the economy was primarily agrarian, it was agricultural, so it wouldn't even provide, very good lessons. So I wanted to try and get one where we had a roughly, growing industrial economy. And in particular, I chose the 1870s one. One, because it's listed as the longest contraction by the MBER, Business Cycle Dating. So it's from 1873 to 1879, which is 6 years. It's longer than the 1929 to 1933 contraction. And in particular, there's also some other interesting features. The money supply was declining during this time. So it was a gradual decline in the money supply. It's sort of regarded as this long depression. You know, I think it was called, you know, the Great Depression before, you know, you had the real Great Depression of the 1930s. And you have this 6 year recession. You sort of want to say, okay, what went on during that time? You know, was it as bad as it was really thought to have been?
Now, in doing this, what you're doing is showing first the applicability of Austrian business cycle theory to particular historical episodes. But then secondly, you have to explain, because Austrian business cycle theory can talk to you about the boom period and then the fact that there's going to be a bust. But then the actual day-to-day operations and working out of that bust are going to be based on historical contingencies of one type or another, and the length of the bust period can be accounted for in sometimes by government policy. But in the 1870s, people would want to know, well, what would be that government policy? Is there any way that you can say that either the government encouraged money creation and credit expansion and interfered in the economy to delay the recovery? These are the sorts of things most people wouldn't know about, but I think they would assume that these things are minimal, that the government involvement was so minimal that it would really be a reach for Austrians to try to explain this episode with reference to either government encouragement of an increase in the money supply or government hindrance to recovery. So let's take both of those then and look at the boom phase. On the show notes page, tomwoods.com/418, I'll link to an episode we did on Austrian business cycle theory. So if you want to give a 1 minute overview of that, rest assured I have a full episode going into all the details. But start with that, and then let's see how this actually fits into the Austrian story.
Yeah, so the Austrian business cycle theory, it basically says that through government action or the overexpansion of banks, usually through a central bank. In this case, it was actually through a new legislation called the National Banking Acts. You have an overexpansion of you have credit expansion, and this artificially lowers the interest rate. The interest rates in the economy, and this sort of incentivizes entrepreneurs to expand in long-term production processes. So, but in reality, time preferences haven't lowered. So the interest rate misleads entrepreneurs. And what happens is, as this new money filters throughout the economy, the public respends it according to their old time preferences, and this sort of reveals the malinvestments. And you sort of have a tug of war as new money is pumped in. And eventually, either through a combination of tightening money or, entrepreneurs just realize that their businesses are unprofitable. You know, these malinvestments through increasing costs and, decreasing revenue, so decreased profitability, they have to liquidate them. There's the bust, and then you have the contraction. So I liked how you also said, you have the boom. The business cycle explains the boom and the immediate bust. But in a sense, you also have this idea of how do you explain, what actually occurs during the bust. So this is something that a lot of people find, is controversial with Austrian business cycle theory, because it sort of, in a sense, it sort of calls for a policy of laissez-faire during the bust, that the resources have to be reallocated from the malinvestments to where they're relatively more profitable and where they can more efficiently satisfy consumer desires. And, consequently, the traditional government management tools, expansionary fiscal monetary policy, Austrians would say that this would only, hamper the recovery. So the fiscal policy would, the increased government spending, it would simply prolong to distort resources, wouldn't allow them to flow into their, their most valued uses. In the increased monetary expansion, it wouldn't allow for the proper liquidation to ensue, and for interest rates to fully reflect, the public's time preference. So during this period, as you said, there isn't a lot of government intervention. So fiscal policy after the Civil War, the Treasury, they're running surpluses. Tax receipts were declining, but government spending was declining even more. So during this period, there wasn't really fiscal policy, expansionary fiscal policy. Even more so, you can't really find accurate yearly data on state and local governments, which you need to fully gauge total government spending. And in terms of monetary influence, there was some expansionary monetary policy during the actual – what I would consider the actual bust, the recession period, 1873 to 1875. We can go into that a little bit more later if we want. But aside from slight, minor government contraction of the money supply from 1875 to 1879, there wasn't the traditional expansionary monetary policy that we usually associate with a government trying to, combat a recession.
All right. So talk to us about the period from 1870 to 1873. This is the period that you identify in the paper as the boom period. Where was the boom? Where would we find in the economy this particular boom? Like, we can easily see the boom taking effect in the bust that we had from 2008. We see the housing sector in particular. What do we see in the 1870s?
So the main malinvestment, I guess, the big, sort of the hot investment going on at this time was railroads. So through a lot of government intervention during the Civil War, a lot of land subsidies, monetary and also land subsidies were granted out to various railroads. You had the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific, and then you had the Northern Pacific. And, consequently, there are all sorts of railroads that branched off of these main lines and other sorts of, state grants. So railroads completely it was a huge booming time for them, especially, in the early 1870s. A lot, I think I cite in the paper, railroads, they were a significant long-term investment. I think they constituted about 15 to 20% of investment at the time. They were also financed, by foreigners and through credit expansion. So you had a lot of businesses, a lot of entrepreneurs embarking on new railroads. This is sort of the demand. The country was, seemed to be expanding westward, and it needed these, you could say, very, capital intensive, long-term production processes to expand the production structure and to sort of, improve the country's output capacity. But what happened was, before the panic of 1873, a lot of railroads, they were starting to experience a rising cost of production. So in terms of labor, raw materials, building track, locomotives, et cetera. And they also started to see, decreased revenue. So they weren't really getting as much money as they thought they were. And this is sort of something that the Austrian business cycle theory says what will happen. Entrepreneurs will realize that these projects weren't profitable. They were sort of misled into embarking upon them, and instead they're facing, resource constraints, rising costs, particularly because these resources are being more urgently demanded elsewhere. So I try and show this because I wanted to make my analysis sort of as trying to be as unbiased as possible through the Davis Industrial Production Index, and in particular the machinery component, which had a large component of locomotives, which are, obviously that's what railroads use. So I tried to show, during this time, there's a boom, significant rise in prices and production of, you could say, mining, chemical and drugs, machinery. There's also a building boom. There's a building boom in Chicago at the time. So these were sort of industries that we would expect that there would be a boom, from the Austrian business cycle theory analysis.
All right. So then, of course, we have a bust. Now, there have been all different discussions of the scope of that bust and how bad it was, and we can talk about that in a minute. But I guess in order to understand the bust, we also need to know not just about the sectors of the boom, but we need to know something about the monetary system at that time, because I think it's kind of complicated. So what can you tell us about that?
Okay, so in terms of the financial system, there obviously wasn't a Federal Reserve at this time. There wasn't a central bank. So during the Civil War, the government, for various finance reasons, in order to fund the Civil War, they issued a large amount of greenbacks. So they took the country off the gold standard, and they also tried to create a quasi central banking system. Sort of it was originally called the National Currency Act. It's later sort of known as the National Banking Act, and this sort of created a multi-tiered financial system, banking system, where banks could pyramid off of other banks' deposits. So what you would imagine, you would see in a free banking system, this is something Mises always emphasized, is that competing banks, there would be a strong tendency to prevent overexpansion, because if one bank expanded too much through the adverse clearing mechanism, that bank's notes and deposits would be returned to the bank, and it would face a specie outflow. But in this system, banks were, you know, allowed to pay interest reserves. They were allowed to hold certain parts of a certain amount of their reserves on at other banks. So there's at other banks, particularly you had central reserve banks, you had city reserve banks, then you had country banks. And the country banks were allowed to pyramid off of the city reserve and the central reserve banks, and the city reserve banks were allowed to pyramid off the central reserve banks. And so banks were incentivized to do this because they could earn interest on these deposits, and also through various branch banking restrictions, they wanted to diversify their investments. And this allowed for much credit expansion to grow much more rapidly than what you would expect under a free market. So, and the other thing was that state banks, so banks who weren't in the national banking system, there were a lot of state bank laws that allowed them to pyramid off of national banknotes. So you really had a four-tiered system. And what happened was after the Civil War, there wasn't that much expansion. It was really the money supply was only increasing by about like 2% from like 1867 to 1870, 2% a year. But then afterwards, you had an enormous spike up. You know, up to rates of 10% per annum. So this is an enormous change, and you had this was due to one. There was an increase in the allowance of national banknotes, which state banks could use to expand credit off of, and also just the banking system was able to shed reserves that could flow into the state banks to expand, so they could expand credit. So really, as after the Civil War, there's a little bit of time to get the system going. And then starting around 1870, there's an enormous increase in the money supply. And I sort of mark that as the beginning of the boom for this period. So roughly a four-year period for the boom.
All right. So that's good. That's good. Is there a precipitating factor that leads to the bust? Is there it happens in 1873. And it was what does 1873 look like, in other words?
So the end of 1872 into 1873, there were a lot of troubles with the railroads. So the railroads, sort of, as I said before, they decreased profitability. They weren't making as much money as they thought they would, and their costs were higher than what they thought they would be. And in particular, you had Jay Cook. So he's the Philadelphia banker of Cook & Co., which is sort of the prominent banking house. His failure eventually, it was sort of overtaken by J.P. Morgan, but he was the big investment banker of the time. And he sort of took upon underwriting the bonds for the Northern Pacific, which was the last, transcontinental railroad, in the Civil War grants that were given. I think it was 1864. And so he was having trouble due to the decreased profitability of railroads and the I think the interest rates were slightly rising. Banks, railroads were having to borrow on the short term. And this is giving a cost squeeze. During the summer, he was having trouble obtaining, he had all these bonds. He was having trouble selling them. And then Cook & Co. went bankrupt. And this was sort of seen as, it was this prominent investment bank. And it sort of sparked. It was one of the reasons that created the financial panic, because people started to realize, is the other bank safe? And there's a run on brokerage houses and some commercial banks. But yeah, the Cook & Co., the decreased profitability of the railroads, 1873, and the failure of Jay Cook's company were sort of I would argue is what I've sort of uncovered in the record, sort of the catalysts for the panic.
Now tell us something about the depth of the bust. How bad were things? What's the traditional story? What did you find?
So the traditional story is that it was atrocious. It was terrible. It was this long depression. You either have analysis that will say, okay, the output decline wasn't as much as the Great Depression, but it was still so protracted. So you still had this six-year decline in output. You look at the contemporary records, they say there's massive unemployment. And when you look at the modern output records, you sort of say, okay, You could see there being a severe recession from 1873 to 1875, even though some of the output statistics, they don't even go into contraction. They just show a slowdown in growth. But really from 1875 to 1878, 1879, there's a rebound in growth. So you sort of have to imagine, okay, what's going on? How are you getting these output statistics that say one thing, and then you have these contemporary reports that say another? So through the historical record, I was sort of able to find that a lot of contemporary reports, they were misled by the decline in prices and just sort of the general lack of economic statistics and information. So businesses would see that there's this, you know, this continuous fall in prices, you know, prices, wages, you know, stock prices, et cetera, they're all falling, and they think this is a decline in real value. So they say it's this grind, you know, it's this terrible depression, when in reality, they were sort of misled by the fact that prices overall were falling. So it was really a nominal illusion. And at the same time, you also had businessmen or, you know, in various newspapers who are giving wildly inaccurate statistics. So they were saying unemployment. There was one newspaper that said unemployment was in like the construction industry was larger than, you know, in reality, later statistics found out than the total amount of construction workers by, you know, in the country as a whole. In that unemployment relief agencies were miscalculating unemployment. So in a sense, you sort of have to take it, the everyday businessman, the everyday worker, he hears this information. It's not like he can go online and calculate prices. He doesn't have, you know, the information that we have now. And he sees, okay, here's prices are falling. He just sort of always reminded of this continuing depression. The money supply is falling too. So you just assume, okay, we're just in this depression. Even though output is still, you know, output rebounded, you know, after 1875. So this is sort of conflicting with the facts. You can't really have a protracted depression if output is increasing, you know, 3-4% per annum. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, then tell us about the recovery. How long does the recovery really take? Not according to, you know, anecdotal statistics in newspapers, but according to your own study, how long does the recovery take? And is there anything that might be slowing the recovery down?
So the recovery during this time, I said that the recovery took from 1875 to 1878. I sort of tried to cut off 1879 because that was the resumption of the species, the U.S. went back on the gold standard, and there's a large increase in the money supply then. So traditionally, business, you know, modern economics would say that was sort of the beginning of the recovery. You had this big boom, prices were rising again, money supply was increasing, this large jump in economic activity. That's usually, as I said, is the traditional explanation, you know, the end, you know, the beginning of the recovery, since the Depression continued all the way through 1879. However, I tried to argue that by 1875, the recession was really over. And I'm not alone in this. So Joseph Davis, he created the Industrial Production Index, which I used in my paper. It was one of the indexes I used in the paper. He also concluded that really the recession rose from 1873 to 1875, and that there's the beginning, you know, of an increase in growth from 1875 to 1878. So one of the things I would actually sort of argue prolonged the depression was that from 1873 to 1875, there's an increase in the money supply, which, you know, if it was, you know, spent by businesses, would sort of prop up prices in production and prevent them from being liquidated. And I tried to argue that, in fact, the contraction in the money supply during the bust sort of there's explanations to argue that it could help the recovery, which is provide some various theories. I tried to show that from Rothbard and Mises, they argue this, and there's various ways that monetary contraction can be beneficial. But so during this time, you had the reallocation of resources, particularly railroads were declining during this time. This isn't a bad thing as predicted by the Austrians. These businesses overexpanded. They need to liquidate, allow the resources to be used elsewhere. But you had a rebound in the other sectors of the economy, which is I tried to show even during the bust, 1873 to 1875, and during the recovery, there was all different movements in relative prices and production. So the bust hit the higher order industries the hardest, which is sort of what the Austrians would say. And during the recovery, there was sort of a recovery in these industries in general. And it's not just simply like aggregate production shocks where the economy is hit evenly and the main cause of the recession is like an aggregate demand failure. I tried to show it was relative prices in production, which is how the Austrians explain the recession and the reallocation of resources during a bust in recovery.
All right. Well, looking at the whole story then, you've basically given a completely revisionist account. Right. I mean, you've now it's not like nobody has ever chipped away at this story before. I mean, Rothbard was certainly groping toward the correct answer in his work. But wouldn't you characterize that as what you've done?
Yeah, that's what I'd like to imagine that that's what I did. I tried to use Rothbard's America's Great Depression as a model for my work. In a sense, I tried to provide a revisionist account, just as Rothbard did. You know, so the traditional account is the Great Depression was caused by laissez-faire and Herbert Hoover did nothing. And Rothbard tried to show that the Great Depression was caused by, you know, expansionary government monetary policy. And that was exacerbated by government intervention. At the same time, I tried to show that, you know, this wasn't just sort of a recession that came from the instability of the free market. There was government intervention that caused it. At the same time, the recession is actually an example of, you know, how an economy can recover from laissez-faire policies, and that it wasn't this protracted depression, but in reality, during the later part of the decade, you know, the mid to the later part of the decade, there was strong growth. So yeah, in a sense, I tried to provide a revisionist perspective of this period that hopefully at the least will change, you know, provide some incentive for people to stop using the MBR dating method of saying it's a recession from 1873 to 1879, which is simply way too long. And it's based off of faulty statistics.
And of course, once in a while, you get people who support the Fed pointing to this historical episode and saying, oh, thank goodness we got the Federal Reserve so we don't get episodes like this anymore. So that goes to show how important it is to get the history right, because if you get the history wrong, you're going to get the current events wrong, you're going to get the policy wrong. So what you're doing has, you know, resonates in the present. What you're doing is not just an episode in historical analysis, as important as that is, but it reverberates all the way up to the present. Well, I'm going to link to the paper. It's an article in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, so people can read it on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/418. I'll also have related episodes here. I did an episode on cycles before the Fed in general that people might find interesting. It's oddly enough, it's one of the most listened to episodes of this show. It says something about my audience. One of the most listened to episodes is about business cycles before the Federal Reserve. I just love you guys. What can I say? Patrick Newman, thanks for your time today.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody. Today, now this is an unusual podcast topic, let's face it. But as I'm sure you can appreciate, also an important one. And it's just this kind of topic that I'm always searching for to make this podcast unique. So it won't just be the same old thing over and over again, but you're always learning something new. I hope you enjoy the show. If you like the show, well, then you might enjoy also libertyclassroom.com, where we teach the history and economics they didn't teach you. It is the adult version of the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, although I insist adults would benefit from that as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.